Petersburg Borough Assembly meetings are brought to you by KFSK and Petersburg Wrangell Insurance, helping clients find out how to protect any valuable asset from stamp or teacup collections to houses, boats of all sizes, and everything in between. Plenty of information from the local agents is available at Petersburg Wrangell Insurance, 772-3858.
Please call the roll.
Cindy.
Here.
Jay.
Here.
John.
He's gone.
Mark.
Here.
Nancy.
Yes.
Kurt.
Kurt is excused. He will be back to town in a few days, he said, so.
Okay. And Bob.
Here.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So it's time for the voluntary Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Okay, now our next item on the agenda is approval of minutes, and the first approval we need is for the meeting minutes from September 10th, 2015. I'll entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, any discussion or changes brought up? All those in favor of approving that, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Okay, meeting minutes of September 10th, 2015 are approved. And I'd entertain a motion to approve today's meeting agenda or make amendments to it. Is there a motion to do so?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, any changes for today's meeting agenda? Okay, all those in favor of leaving like it is, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, we'll go forward with the way it's presented. First thing on the agenda, or next thing on the agenda, I mean, is public hearing of Ordinance 2015-13. This is an ordinance providing for Chapter 16.24, Cemetery of the Municipal Code, updating fees and current language to reflect borough incorporation. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak under this public hearing time? Okay, seeing no hands coming up, we'll move to the next item on the agenda, and that's bid awards. And first, there's two items there today. The first one is authorization to award purchase of an integrated records management system by Spillman Technologies. And that will be presented by the vendor. And Chief, will you please introduce them and tell them what it give a brief overview, maybe?
Sure. This is Jeff Andrus and Anthony Dorsey from Spillman Technologies. They've got a short presentation for us on the product, how it's going to help us out, help us do business better. And then after that, if the assembly has any questions, we'll be happy to sort those out for you.
Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Jeff Andrus. I'm from Utah and happy to be in Petersburg. This is the second time I've been here. We came up about a year ago and was able to meet with the police department and the various public safety individuals and do a product demonstration as well, spend some time understanding them and a little bit about their needs. I'll take just a second to tell you a little bit about the company, the background and the history and some of the advantages I think that the Petersburg Police Department is going to receive from partnering with a vendor like Spillman. And then my colleague Anthony Dorsey will talk a little bit more about some of the functionality and key features that I think are going to be advantageous. So Spillman is about a 30-year-old company, and it started back with Richard Spillman, who did a senior project in college for the assessor's office in Cache County, Utah. Well, the sheriff got wind of this technology called computers and asked if Richard Spillman could write a program for them. So Richard Spillman worked with the sheriff's department and the local police department to write a program that would allow them to keep track of not only the bad guys, but also do things like dispatching and 911. Now, something unique about that, 30 years ago, Richard Spillman wrote the system so that it would operate in a multi-jurisdictional environment, so that multiple agencies could share the same system but still keep their data and their information separate. Well, fast forward to 9/11, and the buzz of interoperability and data sharing, now everybody's trying to modify systems to be able to accommodate those types of features that Richard Spillman saw out in advance. You know, something I think key to Spillman that is unique, well, a few things. Number one is Spillman is still privately held by Richard Spillman. We've never merged or acquired other companies to try to fulfill product needs. All of the products we provide are developed by Spillman and engineered to work together. So that means that when a 911 call is taken, all of that information entered by the dispatcher and pulled over from the telephone, the address and the caller ID information, is going to be populated for the officers out in the car. All of the information the dispatchers are taking will be retrievable by the officers themselves. Now, as the officer takes that call, all of that information is also going to be available down the road to do their report. So when they come in to do their report, they're going to have all of that information working together. So all of the features, all of the programs that the police department is buying through Spillman are engineered to work together so that they work seamlessly and make them as efficient as possible. Another aspect that I think that you all would be interested in is in relation to our licensing and our support. So Spillman is a little bit unique in this regard as well. We include a site license rather than a seat license or a per-user license. So what this means is if the Petersburg Police Department decides to grow or you need another dispatcher on duty or you want to incorporate a mobile command unit, for example, you can do so without needing to come back to Spillman to buy additional licensing for the dispatch or for patrol officers. So fiscally, it's very responsible to be able to have a site license. The second thing is Spillman's policy has always been to include the enhancements and upgrades as part of your annual maintenance. Now, there are a couple of years included with the initial purchase, I think 3 years to be exact. After that, there will be an annual maintenance, but all of the updates, all of the enhancements that Spillman does every 12 to 18 months will be something that the Petersburg Police Department will be able to take advantage of immediately. Every year, Spillman has an annual users conference where over 1,400 agencies are invited to come to Salt Lake and have a week-long training. And there we announce a lot of the new enhancements and releases that are coming up. That's going to take place here in a couple of weeks. So Petersburg can rest assured that they'll always be on the latest, greatest version of Spillman. So that's a little bit about the company, high-level overview. I'd be happy to entertain any questions that you all might have about the company, or we can let Anthony take a minute and ask more questions later.
Yeah, either way, any questions at this point? Okay,
thank you.
All right, so as Jeff mentioned, my name is Anthony Dorsey, and I'm the sales rep for Spillman that covers the state of Alaska. And so he kind of gave us a quick background on the company. I just wanted to go over real quick. I won't get into a lot of the details of the software, but some of the reasons that the police department was looking for a system in the first place and how they'll benefit a little bit. Just a quick background on how we got here today. So back in March of 2014, I had some initial conversations over the phone with the police department, found out what some of their needs were, and we were able to determine that they would be a very good fit for what Spillman offers, right? They're very similar to a lot of the other customers we have. It would meet their needs. In fact, we have, I think Jeff mentioned, 1,400 customers across the nation in 43 states, including Alaska. So we have other customers here in the state, and that's important to note as well because there's state-specific items and requirements that go along with reporting UCR statistics and different things for these police departments, especially if you want to continue to receive grants for the different stats you report. And so Spillman has those standards established already because of the relationship we have with the state. And if they make changes, we make those changes and we update those in the software. So that being said, we had some of these initial conversations, and we came up here, as Jeff mentioned, for an initial visit and did an on-site analysis. And I was able to sit down and kind of do some interviews with different key members of the staff and find out what their needs were in the different departments like dispatch, records, patrol, and jail. And one of the key things is really to have something comprehensive, a suite of software that would cover all those duties. Because right now it's a combination of a manual paper process for some people and then a few different software systems that don't communicate at all, right? They're these disparate systems that don't communicate. So it's this mixture of paper and different systems. And so if you want to find out information, you typically have to go look for it in more than one spot. And so it's not very efficient. And so having a comprehensive suite like that makes it a lot easier to be able to search and find what you're looking for, get information back quickly, and make better decisions, right? Because that's what it's all about. Now the chief can actually go in and very quickly and easily pull out statistics and make better informed decisions about how he wants to use police resources, right, where he wants to spend his time. So that'll give him that information to be able to do so. So that's kind of the brunt of it, I think. But along with that, it having that integrated suite kind of eliminates some of this redundant data entry. If you're writing things down and then also entering it into a record system and then entering into a separate system, it obviously takes a lot of time, and you could be spending your efforts in other places. And those are some of the key needs. I can get into the details about how a lot of that works if you have questions, but are there any other questions that you'd like to, you know, ask?
Any questions at this point from the Assembly?
Mr. Mayor, may I
sure.
ask a... Kelly and Angel, you're in the audience. Can either of you speak to, you know, how does Spillman meet your needs?
I think I can answer that, and Angel can feel free to jump in if I miss something. But like Anthony said, we are, when we get a 911 call or a call coming in for assistance, the dispatcher has to write all that information down. They then have to relay that to the officer and enter that into our system. Then the officer may need to re-enter that information in a report, charging documents. Then we have separate jail records. We have separate property and evidence systems. And Spillman will tie all that together and let us easily retrieve that information that we needed. There's the statistical information that Anthony talked about. You know, we can easily suck that info out of the system to determine what kind of problems we're having, where those problems are occurring, how to, it may help us figure out how to deploy our resources to that. And the information is stored in the cloud in a secure format. So I did a quick review today. Since our last record management system was bought in 2010, we have over 20,000 records. Probably a third of those include some sort of paper document, and they're stored in dozens of file cabinets in the office. So if we need something, we have to find the right file cabinet, search through the file cabinet, find the record. With an integrated RMS, we can simply type in an inquiry and get that information back. So it's going to increase efficiency, improve security, help us track those records, and move through the process seamlessly.
Thank you. Sounds like it'll be a lot more workable than what you're dealing with now. But
it's going to be great.
Any comments or questions?
You said that there's a cost associated with the maintenance after, I believe you said, the third year. What's the cost associated? What's our cost for the, from there on out in as long as we have the system?
I do. The first year of the maintenance cost is included. Years 2, 3, and 4 are just under $14,000 a year, and that's part of the prepaid system. Year 5 and 4, we projected or estimated to be about $14,600 a year. The other thing I want to point out real quick, if I could, is we talked a lot about the police department, and it will benefit us greatly, but it's also going to benefit fire, EMS, search and rescue. We may be able to help out with the mapping, because there's a mapping component to this in economic development. We may be able to help the harbor out with some permitting things as well, and we should be able to share that information across departments, but keep it secure at the same time.
Any other questions? The money to pay for this is part of it, the grant that we've just received, and the rest of it is from state grants. Is that where the money's coming from?
We looked at some funding mechanisms. The we looked at this with our grants and bankings finance folks, and the software is eligible for funding in the legislative grants that we received for the building project, and it has been identified and budgeted in the building renovation project. So that's one mechanism we have. The other mechanism that we have available to us is the E911 surcharges. We collect those surcharges to provide those enhanced 911 services, and we can use those monies
to receive that 911 call, process the call, and dispatch it. So there's a good bit of the modules and components in the system that we could fund it, partially fund it from that fund as well.
Okay, good. Bob?
To feed on to your question, the money that we have in those grants, and I've asked the question, I still don't know the answer, but could that money, rather than to put it towards the system, could that money, in essence, be put towards the remodeling of this building and the jail process? And then, to piggyback onto that question, what's the consequences of that decision of not doing it?
Okay. I can speak to how the money can be used. Kelly will have to speak to the, consequences. The building project design and funding included this expenditure. We knew going in that we would have issues with the software or with this issue, and we wanted to fix it all at the same time. So it's built into the project budget. Can that money be spent with these grants? Yes. Could it not be spent and used all for construction? The also answer is yes. So we wrote the legislative grants are general enough that gives us a lot of flexibility. E-911 is a little more specific. That's a surcharge that are put on people's phone bills, and that has to be specifically used for 911 communications, employees. That expense has to be used for those purposes, so we have less flexibility on how that money is used.
That answer your question, Bob? And this system installed in this old building will be able to be used in the new building if we can get the funding for it. I'd ask the chief this. I just want people to hear that that's so, I believe.
The plan, Mr. Mayor, is to house the software on the virtual servers from our current IT provider. So the software is going to be installed on their servers at a different location. So the software is web-based, and we can log in securely from anywhere. So it's not going to be housed here. It's not going to have to be moved. It's going to be housed with PCS.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions or discussion? Okay. I guess at this point we need a motion to authorize this purchase. I don't think we went that far yet. Did we? Did we make a motion in the second?
So moved.
Nope.
No. Okay.
Second.
Okay. Motion's been made by Member Strand, seconded by Member Greger to award the purchase of an integrated records management system to Spillman Technologies, not to exceed $242,737. Any more discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Mark.
Yes.
Nancy.
Yes.
Cindy.
Yes.
Bob.
No.
Jay.
Yes.
Okay, the motion carries 4-1. Against it, and that was Member Lynn. So we will move on to the next item on the agenda, and that's a motor pool bid award recommendation for police patrol SUV. I'll entertain a motion to award this recommendation.
So moved.
For second?
Second.
Motion has been made by Member Strand, seconded by Member Lynn to award, it's recommended by Carl Hagerman to award the purchase of a 2016 Ford Explorer Police Package SUV to Cal Worthington Ford, purchase of accessories to Alaska Safety Incorporated, purchase of communications from Procom Alaska LLC, and shipping for a total cost not to exceed $45,909.38. So. Discussion.
Mr. Mayor?
Yeah.
Question for Carl. Maybe just for us and the folks at home. Simply put, why do we need it?
This unit has been in service since 2009. Its original life cycle was a 4-year term. We've extended it a couple years, and we probably missed the boat a little bit there. Sometimes we time it right and replace before any major problems happen. This unit right now is missing on one cylinder. We think it's a $2,000 or $3,000 fix. Still runs and it's still usable, but it's not really reliable, and that's not where we want to be with our public safety vehicles. So this is definitely time to replace this unit, and actually having the mechanics evaluate the other units in the police fleet right now to see if we have to jump up any other replacement schedules. All of our units are approaching 100,000 miles, which is rare for us, actually, and I don't want to be caught with another unit that is less reliable, like what we're seeing with this this Charger right now that we're replacing.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
If I may, Mr. Mayor.
Sure.
And I've stated this publicly before about my wish, and I believe the chief feels the same way, to move from the sedan Charger model to a little heavier-duty SUV police vehicle for our, both our climate and our road conditions and ground clearance. That, well, it's not an everyday occurrence that we need that extra ground clearance and kind of rough and tumble approach to vehicles. It happens, and more we're asked to respond for either the troopers or the Forest Service, or we're driving on roads that those Chargers can't handle. And so having the ability to have an SUV that's built on a truck chassis, it's a little more firmly built, I think will allow us to get better use out of them and a little more reliability for the officers. So we're approaching it in that fashion, in the sense that as these Chargers get to the point they're retired, we want to replace those with SUVs, with these units that are, again, a little tougher to, easier to keep on the road.
Any other discussion by the Assembly or questions? Clerk, call the roll.
Nancy.
Yes.
Bob.
Yes.
Cindy.
Yes.
Jay.
Yes.
Mark.
Yes. Okay, the bid award for the new patrol vehicle passes unanimously. And that moves us on to visitors' views related to the agenda. Is there anybody in the audience today with a would like to speak to a view related to today's agenda? Okay, seeing none, that brings us to visitors' views unrelated to the agenda. Anybody in the audience with would like to speak to unrelated items to, about that aren't on the agenda? Okay, seeing none. Board, commission, and committee reports, there is none. Consent agenda, no items under that this week or this meeting. And report of other officers, that brings us to the mayor's report. There's a few extra items added onto it, but we'll start off with the first one that's listed on the agenda, that elections, absentee voting began September 16th in the borough clerk's office. It will continue Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. until noon on Monday, October 5th. Election day is October 6th, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. at Parks and Rec. First Responder Appreciation Day. Governor Walker has proclaimed September 27, 2015 as First Responder Appreciation Day in Alaska and encourages all Alaskans to recognize the vital role first responders play in our state and express appreciation for the selfless service of the first responders in our local communities. Draft Comprehensive Plan and Waterfront Master Plan. The borough is seeking comments on a new draft comprehensive plan and waterfront master plan. The plans can be reviewed or downloaded by going to the borough's webpage at www.petersburgak.gov and clicking on the provided line. Comment deadline on the draft plan. The draft plans is September 30th, 2015, right around the corner. And we're seeking letters of interest. Petersburg Historical Preservation Committee has a vacancy for an architect or at-large member. Appointee will serve until December 13th, 2015. Letters of interest may be addressed to the borough clerk and emailed to dthompson@petersburgak.gov or mailed to Box 329, Petersburg, 99833, or you can drop them off at the office. Notes here. One thing I'd like to just give a little plug for the election, for the ballot that we have on it, is to opt out of the APOC ruling. And I think there's going to be a public meeting, or Joe, are you going to do an interview on that? Or?
I'm doing a forum on it sometime next week.
Okay. I hope people listen to that. I think it's important that we opt out of that. So vote yes is my opinion on that item, on the election. It might help get more people involved in these positions within the borough. Timing, I might not make the first meeting in October. I think starting in October, the meeting should also go back to Monday times. First meeting is at noon, and the second meeting of the month is at 7. I'd like to have them both in the evening, but haven't been able to make that happen yet. And reminder, Saturday, October 3rd, will be the second sales tax-free day. So with that, that is the end of the mayor's report. I think you don't have anything else I should add, do you, Debbie, at this time?
I do not.
Okay. And that brings us to the manager's report.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Sandy's working
One more thing, important thing. We need to...
Sorry, my bad.
Yeah, well, I should have read a little farther. I need to, let's see, let me get in here, go a little farther.
Do you want no paper?
Well, I don't have the names of the people.
Here you go. You can read right from here.
Okay, where are we at here? Okay, here we go. I would like to appoint to the following individuals to work at the October 6th election: Kathy Harris, Mary Leonard, Erica Warhatch, and Chad Wright. The election workers will be compensated at the rate of $12 per hour. And also, we need to come up with a date and a time for a meeting to canvass the election. There's a time frame on it. We have 13 days. So if I'm doing the math right, Debbie, can we do that at our meeting on the 19th? Mm-hmm. Like at the start of the meeting? The election's the 6th. Add 13 days. That's the 19th.
I think we have to do it by the 13th.
Or by the 13th? Well, no later than October 13th. I've misread that then. Okay. So what works for people? Cindy gets back that afternoon on the plane? I might be out fishing. I don't know. It depends on weather and other things. Kurt will be here. Bob, will you be in town?
Yes.
Jay, Nancy? What's that? 13th?
No, I get back. I'm out the 18th, or the 8th through the 14th.
Okay. Can it be done on the 7th? Is there going to be enough people here? If Kurt, Cindy, you will be gone. Nancy, will you be here on the 7th?
Let me check. As far as I know, I will be.
And
it'll
I'm
be a question
sure
of perhaps someone will have to come and pick me up.
You can arrange.
I got you.
Okay.
I think we have
Monday,
to have four
yes,
present
available.
To have a quorum to hold the meeting.
Yeah. And if it is
Monday.
On the 7th, I believe it's going to need to be in the afternoon because I can accept ballots.
Yeah, Wednesday the 7th, too.
For anyone that is special
that's the next day.
Coming in the mail, that kind of thing.
I thought we were going to do it on the 9th.
We can.
8th, 9th, or 12th would be my preference rather than the 7th. But
Columbus Day, is there any red flags that brings up on the 12th?
Is Columbus Day a holiday?
Unfortunately so. Sorry. My bad.
Okay, let's shoot for the 9th, a couple days after the election.
9th would be great.
I'll try to be here. If I'm not, Bob will be here, Cindy will be gone, Nancy will be here. Jay, when are you leaving?
Noon Jet 8th.
How about the morning of the 8th?
I can do that.
Just throwing ideas out there.
Takes about 15 minutes, am I correct?
Oh, yeah. It's just call a meeting to order and.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fine.
You guys set the time.
As long as I'm here, I can do it.
9.
There you go, 9 a.m. on the 8th.
Perfect.
I'm in.
So, let's do the math again. Nancy, Jay, Bob, and Kurt. So we should have a quorum if I'm not in town, and Cindy will be gone, we know that, and our new member who's not officially signed in yet. Okay, we have a date. 9 a.m. on the 8th, canvas election. That was easy. I think now it's your turn, Steve.
Vote on the election workers?
It's all, as long as there was no objection for the election.
That's how we did it in the past.
No, just want to make sure.
Thank you.
See, there is something the mayor can do without getting
yes, you can. Sandy is working with community development to develop some useful maps for hydrants, locations, and physical addresses for the fire department and EMS. Interestingly enough, this is a tougher issue than it sounds. It includes areas both inside the borough, inside Service Area 1 and outside Service Area 1, where folks are starting to need a physical address for, mortgage documents. I mean, the list goes on and on. And in some cases, they've assigned their own addresses. And we're trying to be helpful to make them make sense with the other existing property that may not have an address. So Liz, Molly, our mapping technician, and the fire department are all working together to try to come up with a system for this so that in the event of an EMS call, somebody that's new to the community can actually find places. And since we do respond with the ambulances outside of service area one. So sounds really simple. It's actually a little more complex than you would think, but we're working through it. Public Works staff conducted some limited excavation out here in our parking lot. They did a great job. It's hard to even see, but if you want to know why, it's related to the potential remodeling of this building and making sure we understand the soil content kind of as close to underneath the building as we can get without digging under the building. Everything turned out well, no issues at this point, and the engineer that was here, I haven't heard any bad reports from what they saw. So again, continuing through that process. Thanks to the water plant staff and boreal controls of Juneau, we got that influent valve fine-tuned. It's now working as it should. And we also, while we were here, we had them install the new water and wastewater SCADA backup computer. This is SCADA, basically supervisor controls that allows the staff to control pumps and levels and tanks and things like that without having to physically go out there and basically use the computer system to do that and make sure that our water quality stays where it is and wastewater as well goes where it's supposed to go. Lots of back and forth, but I think it's actually fixed now. But we had a water leak in the crane dock parking area. Thanks to Alaska Rural Water Association as well as Public Works and GLOW staff and all sorts of folks to kind of figure out where the leak was coming from. I think we're in a position where we now have to replace some pipe, and it is basically rotted out. It's old ductile iron that has got a lot of holes, and the first few attempts at patching it just created leaks in other spots. So Carl's folks are working through that. And while those folks from ARWA were here, we were able to do some leak detection surveys and evaluation of the treatment plant and the backflow prevention support. So again, trying to make use when we get these folks to town, in all cases, take full advantage of them rather than having to deal with reduced budgets and less travel down the road. Looks like the asphalt should be going down soon on Haugen. Thank you, Carl. Thanks.
Mr. Manager, talking to CECON this morning, they are blending their aggregate this morning. They have to mix their, complete their mix design for their asphalt. They're working on that this morning. They should have their hot mix plant fired up this afternoon, knock on wood. And we'll hopefully, if the weather cooperates, they'll start either patching our stuff or putting asphalt down on Haugen Drive. So we're almost there.
Thank you, Carl. As Carl mentioned, that includes some of the patches that folks have been concerned about in and around the Sandy Beach area and some other spots where hopefully they get this done and we can then get this stuff patched. Just a reminder, property taxes are due September 30th in the finance office. We're continuing to hear from CECON that the project will shut down on the 30th. I'm not sure how that'll swing. Then they'll come back and return in, March, April to finish up the rest of it. And that includes the remaining sidewalk replacement on Nordic, paving of Nordic Drive, including the bridge, and paving of the new Haugen Drive bike path, which will all be done in 2016. Thanks to Public Works, one of the problems, opportunities of potentially remodeling and moving a building or moving staff is what do you do with old records? And we got rid of about 40 old boxes of records that we burned up at the Baylor. And we're, as time allows, we're trying to go through some of the old stuff to figure out what we need to keep, what needs to be done away with, and at the same time trying to update our borough record retention guidelines. I mean, an example of something that is we can't figure out why, which is it's for personnel records, it's set at 50 years. We really can't figure out what's the logic for why we would want to keep personnel records for someone who hasn't been employed for 50 years. Nonetheless, that's what our current policy is. So there's a cost to that. It's cost in file cabinets, the cost of moving stuff around, to storing it, and as we talk about potentially having to move our operation temporarily if this building does get remodeled, that's a very large cost to have to take that into account. So we're trying to go through that process in an organized fashion. Library is working with the Clausen Museum on setting up a program with the author of The Alaska Salmon Traps, Their History and Impact on Alaska. The author will conduct a talk and presentation at the library, followed by an open house at the Clausen Museum with a book signing, discussion, and viewing of artifacts. Either the museum or the library can give more information on that when they get dates nailed down. Basically, the time of year for Glo and her staff and anybody else that helps her in that to get the regular harbor maintenance and planning for some of our major items, such as replacing the carriage bolts on the South Harbor grid and fixing a damaged hinge on the outer South Harbor finger foot. I put this in here. This happens every year in a sense of the standard maintenance and some of the bigger items. It's one of the, you know, the tough things that we have to keep an eye on, which is if we're going to extend out into the future and say we want our harbors to last even longer, that annual maintenance becomes even more important to keep it from avoiding even more damage if it's not fixed. So it's something I've asked Glo, and she already does that really well anyway, but you know, trying to keep a real close eye on those things that, if not dealt with, can be a lot more expensive to fix down the road. We've had, interesting enough, a fair amount of vessels inquiring about winter moorage. So far, we picked up an additional half dozen larger 48 to 75 foot stall holders, and signing up two is permanent. So, good news on that. The building engineers on this on the remodel project are reporting to us that we're at the 65% level. What does that mean to the general public? It means that until we get to 95%, it's kind of hard to know what costs are doing, going up, going down. So far, they have been in our favor. We've got three big issues that we're concerned about. One's the elevator. There's, for years, evidently, it leaks, and there's a sump down underneath it that we pump out on a regular basis. We need to find out what's causing that, and is it something that we need to worry about or not? The controls in the elevator are, let's just say they're out of date. So we have an option to replace just the electronics in the project. We're hoping that's all we have to do. What we don't want to have to do is rebuild the whole shaft. And that's one of those things that the engineers are kind of weighing in. They've talked to Otis Elevator and trying to figure out, you know, big unknown. That's the stuff that happens between now and getting to 95%. We start to tie that down. Two other issues on that. The foundation under, let's see, that way a little bit. So basically my office and kind of the finance area, that foundation was fixed sometime in the past. They pumped a kind of a concrete foam in there. Actually, it's about 4 inches thick, which is way too heavy. And we're a little concerned about how much that will settle and if, in fact, that will have to be taken out and replaced with something less thick that will have less impact on the ground underneath. Again, we don't know the status of that yet. It's actually not a huge area, but it is an area that we've got to deal with. We don't want to redo the building and then have the foundation slide later. So, the flooring slide later. Something I've said before, but it bears repeating. This building, the walls are actually on really good footing. We're not having any issues with the main structural walls. It appears to be just the floor. Not that that's not a big deal, and if you go witness the police building, what happens when the floor does weird things, it can change the dynamics inside the building. But it's been a positive in the sense that we know that the walls are structurally sound. The foundation piece, if we can fix that, says, you know, we can actually do and have a building that's going to be good for 50 or 60 years or better. And then the last issue that we're concerned about that we've actually gotten Joe Nelson to help us with, which is currently the police is supported from a generator perspective by the build a generator that actually is housed at Power and Light. So power goes off, they still have power, we can get people in and out of cells, we can, you know, take 911 calls and so on. There's some question between the building engineers and our resident electrical engineer and Joe Nelson on whether the existing generator can support the new building or not. We believe it can. Joe believes it can. They're working through the details on that. It's an expensive thing. We don't really, we were going to put a added alternative in the project to replace that and add a second generator just as a backup. But we really don't want to have to put that in the base bid if we can avoid it because it's expensive. So, but interesting enough, there's a whole conversation on what size is needed, you know, and that's where Joe's expertise is coming in handy. You know, it's like, do we really need one that big versus a smaller one that can supplement what we already have? So we're working through that. Again, one of those issues that'll kind of shake its way out as we get it to the 95% stage. We expect that stage to be hitting us in early November. Again, some delays primarily due to some of these things we found that are making the engineer's job a little harder to get to those specifics. So we'll find out. Officers Rowley and Preston will need the 2-week Alaska recertification course instead of having to go through the entire police academy. So it'll be held in Sitka in February, and we'll have them scheduled for that as well. Officer Pop began the DARE classes at the elementary school on Friday, the 18th. And see the line crews out. They've been busy trimming trees around our power lines. I know that upsets some folks, but if we don't do that and keep it good, then when you have a little bit of wind or a tree falls over, most people get a little more excited if their power is out for a really long period of time. So a little preventative maintenance is pretty helpful in that area. We actually share a bucket truck with Wrangell. Some of the trees and the lines are high enough, rather than us having to go buy a big bucket truck. I made the suggestion a couple years back, why don't we see if Wrangell's willing to, you know, we pay for it, but we barge it over here. We use it and barge it back. A whole lot less expensive than us having that size bucket truck here on the island. We hope to be able to do more of that kind of stuff between us and Wrangell. Saves us both money in the long run. And the annual FERC inspection of Blind Slough will be held on the 25th of September, or 23rd of September. That's been in the works for a while, lots of planning, you know, lots of documents required by the feds to make sure we can continue to keep that facility permitted. It's one of the reasons we can keep our power rates so low is that we've got this fully paid for hydro project sitting out there that generates power. And, you know, in a year like this, especially when it's chock full, we're running as full as we can. So anyway, that's it, unless there's questions.
Any questions of the manager?
I've got a
Jake?
No.
I've got a couple. Yes, whose policy is it that we keep the personnel records for 50 years? Is that state or is that ours?
Well, you know, that's a great question. Actually, it's the assemblies, believe it or not.
It is the state's policy, records retention. And there is some reason for it, Steve. When people retire, let's say they worked for us when they were 20 and they got to be a tier one PERS and then they left and years go by, we don't know anything about them, but PERS wants to make sure that, yeah, they really worked for us. And, you know, I mean, PERS verifies working history when anyone retires. And it has happened to me in my job since I've been here where I can't find the records they're wanting me to find, and it's very frustrating for them and frustrating for the person trying to find the records for them.
To add to that is, I mean, some examples. IRS only requires us to keep 7 years of records.
Of some records.
Right.
But not personnel files.
Well, and
It's an ongoing thing. When you get to personnel records, that's big my thing. If you look at the Alaska statutes that said this, it's all recommended. It's by the state's archived group.
Yes.
And, you know, what happens, I mean, and it's typical and there's not a big problem with it. It's easier to grab the whole personnel file and stick it in a folder or stick it in a file cabinet than to figure out what does PERS really need. You know, in other words, what subset of the documents in that file do we need to meet their requirements? And let's save that, and let's not save these personnel files that can be, you know, like this. And because it you know, as Debbie and Mindy know, it's a tremendous amount of money. I mean, we're buying file cabinet upon file cabinet to try to save this stuff. And, you know, how can we go through that in an organized fashion and figure out, and you know, that's my big thing with it, which is let's find out what we're supposed to keep in a organized fashion so that the borough's not having to spend a fortune on, you know, repopulating the world's of file cabinets. As we've seen, I mean, this building, you start to do the design, and we're making offices smaller because we're having to account for having all these file cabinets. So it actually affects the workflow for folks and everything else. So, we're going to have to go through this, and we may or may not get it done prior to the move, but it is something that's now on our big list. You know, so, yeah.
Well, I was just curious who's required it. And one other thing, maybe this is a question for GLO, is that when's our Middle Harbor float going to be complete?
I ask that about once a week. Right now it is being reassembled down in Washington. There was a hang up at the treatment when they had to redo the big beams and stuff and get those sent off to treatment. They don't just do them, they don't dip one at a time as they come in. They wait for a batch to show up and do it all through one process. So Jimmy says it's getting reassembled. You know, it's going to take a couple weeks to get it shipped up here. They're out in Cake now. But drop dead date is October 30th, which I continuously remind everybody, and nobody's asked for an extension yet. So hopefully we'll be back up and running by the end of October.
Perfect. I was just curious.
I noticed
it when I drove out of the harbor this morning. Any other questions of the manager? Okay, we'll move on to unfinished business. And first item there, the only item under unfinished business, is Ordinance 2015-13, an ordinance providing for Chapter 16.24, Cemetery of Municipal Code, updating fees and current language to reflect borough incorporation. I'd entertain a motion to adopt Ordinance 2015-13 in its second reading.
So moved.
For a second?
She did.
Oh, hard of hearing. Moved by Member Lynn, seconded by Member Strand to adopt Ordinance 2015-13 in its second reading. Discussion.
Sure. Carl, a question for you, if I may. For a burial opening and closing, that's really the, as far as I'm reading, the largest change in terms of price structure. So what does it cost, like, to the borough for burial opening and closing? Ballpark, of course.
Actually, I'm going to kick this one to Donnie. He's got the information.
Perfect.
We've researched this, and we're ready for this question.
So. Okay. Thank you.
There's a couple of different parts to that answer. If you guys don't mind, if I can just take a second to kind of walk you through what a process of a normal burial would actually take.
Sure.
So the first step is typically, you know, a family member or the individual will meet with Karen and Public Works' office and talk about what type of burial that they want. So are they going to be buried in a casket, or are they going to be put into, cremated and put into an urn and then put into the columbarium? And so they've got a couple of choices there. Once they've purchased their plot, whether it be in the columbarium or in the ground as a casket, you have that individual price right there. Yeah. So already we've got the time and effort that Karen is putting into making sure that the plots are taken care of, who is actually buried where, what family members are next to them, et cetera, et cetera. So she keeps track of all of that information. Then when the person passes away, then we have the actual work that is ahead of us. And so typically, public works on average, usually it costs them about $1,400 for a burial. And that does not include Jesse's time, because now Jesse is actually a part of Parks and Recreation. And so Jesse is typically the head of this project. And so he will usually have an additional, 5 or 6 hours ahead of time before the public works crew shows up, but getting the actual spot prepped, getting plywood out, making sure that everything is prepared. And so you're looking at another, $300, another $500 there with Jesse's time. So by the time we're done, once we take into account of Karen's time, Jesse's time, and also public works, you could be looking at about $2,000 for one burial.
So then, I guess I'm going to interpret from there, and you correct me if I'm misinterpreting, that the $800 price, as a borough, we're choosing to subsidize that cost to keep it affordable for families in Petersburg.
Most definitely. That was something that Carl and I specifically discussed. When we started actually looking at, and we had Karen go out and say, okay, how much does it really cost us to do a burial? Because we wanted to know.
Sure.
And so when she started coming back with these numbers, Carl and I both said to each other, well, do we charge, our family members that are going to be using this facility the full amount of what it would actually cost? Or do we continue to make this as a public service, which is what it should be?
And, agreed.
And that was the direction that we headed with it.
Thank you, Donnie. Thank you, Carl.
You're welcome.
Okay, any other discussion on Ordinance 2015-13? Clerk, call the roll.
Bob.
Yes.
Cindy.
Yes.
Jay.
Yes.
Nancy.
Yes.
Mark.
Yes. Okay, Ordinance 2015-13 passes unanimously in its second reading. And that brings us to new business. Communications, we have an update from Ag New Beck Consulting on our comprehensive plan process. So,
Chris, the best place to
stand.
Maybe introduce yourself to the public. And
sure.
Thank you.
So my name is Chris Beck, and I'm one of the principals of Agnew Beck Consulting, and we were hired by the borough to prepare a comprehensive plan that's designed to, address the fact of the new expanded area, and I think secondly to respond to maybe the new fiscal realities confronting the state. I think those are kind of the themes that have come out of the process to date, that it's hard to miss this $3.5 billion deficit number that keeps coming up in front of us. So we've been doing a whole lot of listening. And out of that, did a first draft of the plan, which we released back in the summer, and suggested at that point that there would be a review that would happen during the summer. And people came back and said, that's a dumb idea. People are busy in the summertime. Give us some more time. So we said, that's a good idea, and extended the review period to the end of this month. And so we've now been getting comments from a variety of folks, and we showed up on Tuesday afternoon and have been doing more listening. And what I was thinking I might do today would be to describe maybe just briefly the main themes that have been coming up in the concerns and the questions people have asked. And I don't know how much you folks have had a chance to look at the plan. Then the second thing I'd like to do is just take any questions or comments you folks may have about what you ultimately we'll be asked to approve. So where we are is fielding those comments, going to come back and make some revisions in response to those. And I wish I could say that every person we talk to, we can make the change they request, but sometimes person A asks for this, and then person B tells us to do the opposite. So part of our process is to work with the staff. We have an advisory group in the community that's helping us wend our way through these comments, but come up with something that's balanced and reflects the community. So the main subjects that have got people's attention, I think, are in I'll make it three categories. One is the whole issue of land use and extending land use authority outside of service area one. A second one is the waterfront plan, a key piece of the project, because it is a comprehensive plan and a waterfront plan. And then the third, I think, is maybe a broader request for just better communication, particularly between the decision makers at the borough and the people outside of Service Area 1 who are just kind of adapting to this new world and wondering about what happens with the money that they're now paying in taxes and how those decisions get made, those kinds of questions. On the land use piece, no big surprise, it is Alaska after all. When somebody shows up and talks about the possibility of rules that would affect what I can do with my property, eyebrows go up a little bit. And I think what we've come back and explained, and I think has generally been met with a reasonably accepting view, is what the plan is requesting with regards to land use. Three big things outside of Service Area 1. Number one is that the rules for subdivisions that are currently only within Service Area 1 be extended borough-wide. And the logic for that, I think, is pretty compelling, which is right now there are no rules whatsoever for what kind of subdivision you can put in. It comes down to decisions individual landowners make on what they think the market will bear or they want to do. And we've got some fairly compelling anecdotes about the downsides of that approach. The two I've been hearing about in the last couple of days. One is that there's a landowner in town whose parcel is at the top of a small hill, and it turns out that the road between his home and the public road is a private road, and he didn't have any right to use that. The person at the bottom of the hill just as soon have them not use that road anymore. Another example is the road that goes up to Three Lakes down near Papke's. It crosses the Mental Health Trust land. It turns out there's no easement or right-of-way on that. And so somebody trying to run a power line up to the mill there is kind of, you know, groping in the dark. Like, where should that go? Who do I talk to? Is there an easement? You know, those kinds of questions. And I think even longer term is just subdivisions that can go in if the Mental Health Trust, for example, decides to do a subdivision that puts in very small lots that aren't necessarily suited for on-site water and sewer, and that's, or on-site water and septic, and that's uphill from your home, you might end up with impacts on your well, your backyard. So we've been saying, and I think it's fair to say, that maybe one of the main recommendations of this plan is to extend that platting authority, that subdivision authority. There may be some different standards outside of Service Area 1 than in the rest of the borough, and maybe even more so, you know, going across Frederick Sound to the mainland, but some standards. So that's one thing. People have generally been saying, yeah, that seems reasonable. The second one is, right now, many of you probably know, the Army Corps of Engineers has declared all of Southeast as a wetland. You have to get a permit before you can put down a pad to build a home, and often the process to do that is time-consuming, costly, irritating at best. It can be months, it can be years before you get that permit. As you as an individual go tug on the sleeve of the Army Corps and ask for your fill permit. So the suggestion in the plan is to have the borough play a role in that process, be kind of a wholesale advocate of permits, and maybe go the next step and take over that authority at some point and be able to make available mitigation land where some project that is worthy might not otherwise be able to happen. So that's a recommendation. The third one is the one that gets people wondering, and that's the proposal in the plan that there is a generalized land use map that identifies in broad terms the intended land uses on both public and private land outside of Service Area 1. And the plan goes on to say that that could at some point be the reference point for creating a zoning ordinance, which would still have to come before you folks independently of the adoption of the plan. And that ordinance would do two very simple things. It would essentially bless almost all the existing uses that are out there and say, if you've got a residence, you've got a business on your residence, this is rural Alaska, that's fine. But it does say if you have a proposal for a larger scale use that could actually really impact your neighbors, be it a 50-room lodge or an auto wrecking facility or a mill, something of a larger scale that would require going before the Planning and Zoning Commission and getting a conditional use permit, which would give the neighbors notice of that project and would give the P&Z and eventually you, if it was appealed, the chance to put some conditions on that operation. Maybe to say, you got to close down the mill at 10 in the evening. You can't start until 7 in the morning, or whatever those conditions might be that wouldn't stop the use, but would make it a better neighbor in residential neighborhoods in particular. So they're in a burst of words what the land use stuff is, and people ask us about that. And I think there's still people who are going to probably come before you and say, it's wrong, premature, this is the camel's nose under the tent. And eventually people are going to be telling us what color to paint our doors, and I appreciate that. It's Alaska. People live here. I live here because I don't want somebody telling me what color my door should be. But at the same time, we quietly hear people saying, it would be nice, I just put in this nice house, if the person next to me didn't do things that reduced the value of my property or made my life unpleasant. So I'll pause there before I talk about waterfront issues. Any questions? Thoughts? Are you folks going to be comfortable approving a plan that makes those recommendations? Because that will be probably the next time I might be talking to you.
Yeah. One of the things I'm hearing out there is that, you know, you've got 3,000 people sitting here, and you've got 100 people sitting out there. And you've got a steamroller in here rolling over all those people. And I'm hearing that consistently from folks outside.
Yeah.
I think that if anything to do with any planning and zoning outside of service area one should be a vote of those people, not of the people in this town. But any kind of conditions you put out there should be a vote of those people, not the people in town. And that should be a recommendation in your plan, in my view.
Any other comments or questions? Cindy?
I guess along those lines, in order for that to happen, would they need to form their own service area? And I think that would be the case.
That would be another way to approach it, yes. Or if you wanted to add on to what you say, you could separate the rest of the island from the other part, you know, make several service areas. And that was one of the proposals back when that was wrestled.
Okay. I think Member Lynn touches on an important distinction, talking about outside of service area one. And I don't have a solution to this offhand, just kind of bouncing this off of you, is you've got Midcoff Island service area or outside of service area one, then either mainland and or Kuprinoff, et cetera. And I think there's some very distinct land use differences in each one of those, whether it's someone in Keene Channel, Duncan Canal, as opposed to Point Agassiz, et cetera. There's some really unique differences to each of those compared to, let's say, Papke's Landing.
And that's one of the things right now I don't see the plan really addressing at all.
Yes,
it's void of any of that. There is a difference.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think part of the way the plan tries to get at that, and I'm not at all trying to argue, but just to explain, is that the recommendation is for probably what would be the world's simplest zoning system. It basically says, you know, home-based businesses, that's fine. Existing residences, that's fine. You know, if you want to have a greenhouse, no big deal. All those things are fine. The only thing that is proposed that could be regulated would be large-scale uses. And I think from our experience in other locations, it's often those are the ones that leads people coming to the borough at a later date and saying, why did the borough allow this to happen that has so disrupted our neighborhood? And in this case, what the plan is saying is you don't say no to those, but you ask them to go through a process that recognizes their potential impact, and in some instances to add a few rules so they fit into the neighborhood with less disruption. And so we laid it out that way because we recognize people's concern about the camel's nose and the restrictions on their property, and recognize that there should not be a lot of those. But I'm explaining what I've heard from a lot of people and trying to hit a balance point, and it's clearly not my decision at all. And we don't see the plan as our plan. We see the plan as trying to carry forward all the things we've heard from all different people, and wanted to inform you about kind of where we are.
Sure. An example, I mean, I was at Glacier this morning where Agnew Beck was taking comments from folks, and somebody who lives outside of Service Area 1 was very clearly saying, you know, I really think the borough needs to get involved in this air quality thing. This neighbor of mine is put in a wood-fired boiler, and, you know, it affects my life. And we're getting more of that. I mean, you know, to Assemblymember Lynn's, you know, point, and to Chris's point, Liz and others, we're starting to get this. You know, I have this really nice house, and this person's building on our property line. Or this
you know, they've got an in-ground septic system and it's leaking onto my property. Can the borough come out here and do something about it? The answer is no. Not now. And, you know, what the assembly's going to have to struggle with is this issue of, do we do it ahead of time, knowing that if we don't, if the assembly doesn't do this, and somebody decides to build a 50-room lodge, Liz is going to have to say yes. If they come forward and say, I'm going to build this, and I'm going to build this on this lot, and it happens to be right next door to your house, we're not going to have the authority to say no. So there won't be any, you know, at that point in time, it's too late. So it's kind of how much in advance do you want this to happen versus waiting until it's kind of, oh, my God, and now there's less control. And that's what I think the assembly's going to have to struggle with.
Our job isn't to sell this stuff, but I guess two thoughts. One, we're doing a plan right now for the Denali Borough, where they actually have zoning, and the whole borough is zoned unzoned. So there's, that's what the zoning code says. There's no constraints or restrictions. But we've been hired because people are starting to come forward with those problems, and we're being asked to kind of gently explore approaches, specifically because the tourism industry has been so robust at the park entry that now they're beginning to put facilities into Healy. And people who always before said, we don't want that zoning stuff, are now saying, there's a 50-bus parking lot in my neighborhood, and there's new employee housing, and these people run around and partying late at night, and it's lowered my property values and made my life miserable, and you, the borough, be doing something about it. And the borough's saying, well, we don't have, so I mean, just echoing what you're saying. But a different slant on that same argument is one of the big themes of this plan is trying to think for the future about how to create jobs, how to create the revenue that will pay for the school and other facilities. And the reason I think most communities in America have come around to zoning is because it protects property values. And if you're getting ready to build a $400,000 oceanfront house someplace, you are going to hesitate if you know that your neighbor could do anything tomorrow. And I think there's, in my view, this whole island, this whole area has a chance to be a place where people start to see, this is beautiful waterfront land where I could have a great life and build something really valuable, but the lack of any of those restrictions is a deterrent to those kinds of investments. For some people, it's an incentive. I realize it's a complicated story, but there might be some midpoint. And I think when people, in my view, just reflexively throw out zoning, the whole category, it misses the reality that zoning can take many different forms. And there's probably forms that are really excessive and inappropriate here. But there's this kind of more benign Alaska rural version that perhaps is worth considering. So there's my sales pitch, and I'll cool down and stop.
Any more questions on this?
So on the waterfront, do you want another couple minutes? I don't want to take all your time. So the waterfront plan is designed, as the name suggests, to try to make the most of the value of this finite resource. And so the bulk of our focus has been working with GLO and the Harbor Commission, thinking about improvements to the facilities that support the commercial fishing fleet. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that. There's some nuances to sort out about the numbers and some of the explanation of those proposed improvements. But I think of the different parts of the plan that probably need the most refinement, it is this waterfront plan. And the main area where improvements are needed would be to bring up the other non-harbor-based facilities, Banana Point, Papkeys, Agassiz, across the bay, across the inlet here, and at least identify that those are important, often case use is growing, and that right now there are no mechanisms to manage that. And we've heard a bunch in the last couple hours about Kevin, who's working down at Papkeys, and went past the hat, raised $1,500, got verbal permission from DNR to put some concrete in there so that people wouldn't bust up their trailers trying to go up and down that ramp. And we've been hearing there's still steadily increasing growth there, and there isn't any way right now to maintain that facility for safety or convenience. And Kevin's view, and I talked to him at 6:30 this morning, was that it makes sense to just start finding a way to raise some money so that that becomes something that doesn't have to be his job in his spare time. And that maybe you do like you do in Harvard. There's a little user fee. If you park there, you got a sticker, and you raise a little money, and then you work with DNR, who actually owns that facility, to maintain it. And so we won't go so far, we believe, you should tell us if we're off base, as to making that specific suggestion. But we want to go to each of those sites and identify them in the plan as important and raise the issue that some approach is needed if they're going to continue into the future to be preserved so people can continue to enjoy them. And so it's kind of raising the issue and putting it more prominent and identify the specific locations that look like they are really important. So that's kind of that's the theme of this waterfront plan, broaden the scope a little bit, make sure that, and I guess finally we want to look at some of the recommendations within the harbor that talk about accommodating a portion of the tourism industry, the cruise ships that stop, some of the yachts, and make sure that the ideas that are in there actually work for the folks that are intended to benefit. So we're doing a little bit of due diligence on some of those suggestions. So I think we're not far from having a complete waterfront plan, but we want to push it a little bit and make sure it's a little more in-depth, a little broader in its focus, a little more credible.
Questions or ideas, comments? No, I don't see any hands going up, Chris. So.
Okay, just keep, I'll be quick here. I got one more, which is
sure.
A lot of people have said from outside Service Area 1 that it would be good if there was a clear communication between the interests of those folks and you, really, and the decision makers at the borough. And we've heard people bring forward questions and doubts about, you know, what's happening with that 4 mil rate. Is that actually going to benefit the school or not? Has the school budget grown since all these new property tax owners came in? And that's a good example of where the simple answer looks like, well, no, the budget hasn't gone up. But in fact, the reality is it didn't go down because more revenue came in to make up for other revenues that did decline. So I think that's a broader subject that we won't solve. I think we'll identify that it would be valuable to think about how to have ongoing communication that leaves people who might have misinformation or just be frustrated with more opportunities to share those views, have those views heard. The other side of that issue is it's a democracy, and I think I understand three of the group of you are actually from outside of Service Area 1 and, you know, listen to those views. So it's some of it is just get involved. There are a couple different boards and commissions that have empty seats and looking to have people fill those. So there are opportunities. I don't mean to oversell the idea that there's a huge problem here. But where there's misinformation and there might be ways to correct that, where there are lines of communication that might be opened without a lot of pain and suffering, might be worth, people sure asking us to do that. And so I guess we'll try to capture that intention in some way. I think that's most of it. Maybe one other little one is, within Service Area 1, the land use plan suggests an expansion of the historical commercial area that's here on Hammer Slough and shows that right now that's just on the upriver side of the road. We're suggesting that be extended down into the Singley Alley area. And the notion there, like many of the notions in the plan, comes back to an economic goal and trying to keep that area sufficiently attractive that tourists who could take their money and time many places decide, oh, that Petersville, Petersburg, that's a cool place. There's those neat little shops. And it hasn't been dramatically disrupted by somebody deciding to build a 40 by 30 tin, you know, storage space, which right now they could do, and suggesting that that extend down clear to the water, and that's the generalized land use plan map recommendation. That isn't the zoning piece that would actually implement that. So it's the direction would be set by the comprehensive plan. At a later date, there would need to be, if you wanted to go that direction, an actual zoning code that would explain more specifically what it means. And what we're suggesting is that it accommodate diverse uses, commercial uses, residential uses, but they be housed in buildings that are sort of the scale and the form of the historical buildings in that area. It's not too fussy, but it's designed to hang on to some of that character that means people like going there and spending time and money in your town. So I think that those are the kind of the highlights. Were there, I don't know if you've looked at other sections and had other questions, and we'd be happy to answer those now or subsequently.
Any questions?
I'm working on my comments.
Okay.
I'm doing written comments.
It sounds like everybody's satisfied with the...
Well, we hope so.
Yeah.
We, often people are satisfied right until the last meeting. And so we'd rather hear sooner than later if there are those questions, because it just makes life easier for all of us. So if you hear people bringing things up, maybe if you don't go to us, talk to Liz, talk to Steve, talk to Glow, and let us know, and we're more likely to hit the bullseye.
And I can speak to this. I mean, I don't want to chastise him. The deal is, we spent a significant amount of money for this project. They're doing a great job. At the last minute, if questions come up, it's going to cost more, because you know they've committed to do a certain X amount of work for a certain amount of money, and if we have to start over again, in some ways, it costs us more money. I mean, that's just how business works. So it is to the public's benefit, as well as the assemblies and everybody else, to read the plan, get your comments in, and get them to us so that we can incorporate and ask the right questions. We wait to the last minute when we've brought it before P&Z and the assembly for approval. It's a lot harder to make changes and a lot more expensive. So that's
it. Thank you. I guess the only other point or question that I would make, I was shocked in reading the beginning of the plan to see how many people who live in Service Area 1 didn't know they lived in Service Area 1, which speaks to your comment about communication. And if you hear specifics about how we can do that better, and the same with you, Bob, if folks say, you know, we want to have a coffee at this, you know, informal meet and greet at this time or place, even if it's outside of Service Area 1, then let's make that happen, because clearly we are not sharing information in a way that people need to get it if they don't even know where they reside.
Well, and Liz had a thought that mimics the model that's used in a lot of cities, used in Anchorage. Is there's in Anchorage, they're called community councils, and the whole town is split into community councils, and those groups have a formally identified responsibility to be advisory to other decision-making groups. Yeah, that seems a little formal and a little fussy. I don't know. I defer to you, Bob, if something like that would be helpful. But if, you know, if the borough was to twice a year go out and you folks go meet in some of those places, or one of you just reports back, or some way of slightly formalizing the listening opportunities, I think there may be some benefit, and then it'll be harder for people, if nothing else, to complain if you've made the effort. If you try a couple years and that isn't working, you try something different, or you let them elect different people. But I think trying in some new ways is an idea worth considering.
Any other questions of Chris?
Okay, well, don't hesitate to ask if you get more. You hear your friends or you hear somebody saying something that you think we'd benefit from here, and pass it along through Liz or Steve or write to us. Thanks. We've enjoyed working on this and excited about the whole project.
Do you feel you've had a fair level of comments from the public, or you think people haven't been responsive, or?
I think until plans get right up to the end, often you don't hear everything, and where things can go awry is if at the last minute there's a lot of maybe rumors and misinformation about what a plan is about. Mm-hmm. So I never can say with confidence that we've checked in with everybody by any means, because we, you know, we just, and the more one-on-one conversations we have, the better, and we haven't clearly talked to everybody. I feel like we've got a pretty good representation of people, and that's what we always try to do. Shelley right now is up talking to the high school students. We're talking on like half an hour schedule all through the rest of today and tomorrow and much of yesterday. And if there are other people you can think of, it's like, you know, have you talked to this category or this individual? We welcome those ideas. So I think we're doing about as good a job as we can, but you can always do a little better. I don't know, Glow or Liz or Steve, do you feel like there's any big chunk of folks we're missing?
Yeah, I mean, I could speak to the, I mean, well, I don't know that
what else you could have done. I mean,
we've been pretty energetic.
Yeah, I mean, and it's one meeting after another. It's I mean, how many times have you been over to the Kuprinoff, as an example?
Well, we were just there last night.
Yeah,
had a great dinner. Got a good perspective.
We've had public meetings here. You've met all over town. You were at Glacier this morning. I mean, it's one of those things. We can't afford to have you go knock on every door individually. I wish that'd be great, but that's not how things are done. Can't do it. Can't afford it. And so, I mean, I think within the bounds of what monetary concerns are there, that you guys have done a great job reaching out to folks. I mean, we've had how many open houses, how many presentations?
Yeah, quite a few. We had a survey. We had a lot of input. And I'll end on tomorrow at Glacier from 6:30 till 9.
There you go. They're back at Glacier.
They have good coffee. Yeah. They have some nice breakfast bagels. And we'll be there and trying to answer questions and just listening. So if there's that person in you out there with some things to share, we're all ears.
Thank you.
Yeah, so if anybody in the public is listening and you have concerns, there's more opportunities. You have another 6 days.
Yeah, and a face-to-face opportunity tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
So. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for your
thank
time.
You.
Appreciate the thought that you've given to all this.
Thank you. Okay, that brings us to assembly discussion items. And Member Lagadakis is going to give us a report on her visit to Rupert for Southeast Conference.
Well, and there's a lot to talk about, and I'm really going to go over this briefly. If folks have questions, I'll give them a couple places they can go for more information, and folks are more than welcome to stop me on the street and ask questions about Southeast Conference. Liz Cabrera also was there, and I'm sure picked up on some different things than I did. When we got to Prince Rupert, it was the first time that I'd been there in the daytime. The only other time I'd been there was on the ferry in the middle of the night. It's from the waterside, so tremendously different than what you see in Southeast Alaska for the most part. The population is just over 12,000. It's interesting to see the diversity in their economy. They are shipping grain, coal, timber, and we saw log rafts of timber going on like 500-foot ships. They're also home to the largest seafood processor on the West Coast, and I think they said in North America. I didn't quite catch that because we were on a boat trip at the time, and it was hard to hear. What I was really surprised to hear about that is Alaska fishermen are delivering fish to that processor, which means money out of our pockets, if you want to look at it that way. Much of what they're shipping is going to Asia, which was very interesting too, and it's a very, very active port. They've invested in container shipping facilities, and they're looking to be involved in the proposed liquid natural gas project that is also involving Alaska. And they're also very interested in being a business partner with Alaska, although there was a lot of background questions about how we would do that international business opportunities. The presentations at Southeast Conference centered around mining, transportation, LNG proposals. State budget was a big part of that picture. Shipping, tourism, and tribal interests, just to name a few. And though the liquid natural gas proposal is interesting, the companies involved are still somewhat on the fence about how much they want to be involved and if they want to commit financially. So it was interesting to hear that it's sort of full steam ahead but one foot on the brake when you hear them talking about the proposal. Another thing that was really a little bit of an shake your head moment was I picked up a paper one morning in the hotel that we were sitting in. Petronas is the company, or at least one of the companies, that's supposed to be supplying the gas. They were on the front page of the paper as having failed safety audits in 2013 and were facing a number of fines, had shut down some operations internationally. So there's still a lot of things to be resolved there. Could be an opportunity, but obviously there's some cards that still need to be dealt. We heard from the Deputy Commissioner of Alaska Marine Highway System, who painted a pretty bleak picture about the finances and the state of the ferry system. I think everybody's pretty well aware of what those issues are, and we challenged him a little bit in that he talked about the rising cost of the ferry system, and we said, you know, there's also rising costs to maintaining and building roads, so you need to talk apples to apples. It's not just that the ferry system is operating in a vacuum and is the only thing that's increasing in costs. Dave Kensinger of Chelan Produce followed his presentation, Mike Nissel's presentation, and Mike is the deputy commissioner, by proposing elimination of mainline ferries over cheaper shuttle ferries between communities without road access, and said the ferry system priority should be those communities that don't have access any other way. The elimination of the mainline ferry proposal was definitely an undercurrent of, that generated a lot of discussion in the background at Southeast Conference. I don't think people are necessarily on board, although they understand the reason for Dave proposing that. Dave also advocated for a citizen board over an advisory board, and if you've been listening to KFSK, they did a really good job of covering some of the issues and comments and background about why that would be beneficial. Let's see. We also heard Southeast by the numbers, and that was presented by Wayne Coast Data. And they noted a couple things. In the past 5 years, we've reached all-time highs in state population, workers, and workforce earners, though most of that occurred in the beginning of the five-year period. In the last year or two, that trend has shifted downward. Since 2013, our population has declined slightly, and I think they said it was something like 30 people statewide. Our population has changed. So that, to me, doesn't seem like a significant number, but still a downward trend. Jobs have also decreased, mostly in government, construction, and health care. Visitation by ferry and cruise ship passengers in the last couple years was down by 34,000 people. I didn't hear that they parsed out how much of that was ferry and how much of that was cruise ship. And counter that with their overall trend of visitation being the one sector in Southeast Alaska that has actually been on an increasing trend over the last few years. So that number didn't track with that, and I would need to look into that a little bit more to figure that one out. In the last couple of years, the value of seafood declined by $92 million. Oil production has declined almost continually since 1988. Despite this, their survey of top managers and business owners in the state is still positive. Their outlook is still positive for our economy, which also I found very interesting. Looking at the numbers that rainforest data had presented, the Forest Service lost the most jobs. They lost 80. But private maritime and Coast Guard gained over 800 jobs in the period between 2010 and 2014. Government comprises 35% of Southeast regional earnings, which is a big, big piece. We also heard from Pat Pitney, who went over the budget. There is a budget tool that you can use. It's on the state website. Anybody can manipulate it and sort of play budget god. If I make this change, how will that affect revenues? And so we worked through that. We proposed a bunch of things and watched how the numbers went up and down. It was a very sobering presentation. She said of state expenditures, the top three expenditures in the state are education, payments and obligations, and health and social services. Education is K through 12. The university was separate and a much lower portion of the budget. Payments and obligations included tax credits, some of which we must pay, even if they don't benefit. We have to, even if the governor makes some changes to oil tax credits, we have to make good on the ones that were already negotiated. So those will be continuing expenditures for the state. Retirement is also a big part of that. And those three things were a tremendous part of the budget over the other portions of the budget. So when you look at where you have opportunities to cut away from different sections of the budget, you realize that many of the things we're talking about cutting, including the ferry, aren't going to get us big gains if we eliminate them, because they really don't affect the budget as much as those top three items. The state is looking at some efficiencies to save costs, but they don't expect to realize more than 1 to 5% savings in any particular function. So that probably isn't going to gain us a whole lot. They've already done their big budget reduction, and it's not possible to make another budget reduction of the same magnitude in this year. So that's also something to consider. The administration is seeking to maximize federal dollars. However, we know that, you know, on some levels, federal dollars are also declining. A couple of the, all the changes can't be made in the next legislative session. Changes will be ongoing, so this is a road that we're going to be on for a while. And a couple of the conversations for places to generate revenue are, of course, taxes. Alcohol and tobacco in Alaska, I believe, we are nationwide the lowest taxer of those. However, that primarily affects individuals. And because of our state population, some of those things are not real opportunities, like gaming. Because our population is not large, we're not going to gain a lot of money, even if we instituted some kind of a lottery system or other gaming system. Two things that I've heard talked about, both by Pat Pitney and Alaska Municipal League, are caps to the PFD and using some of those additional excess revenues for the state, maintaining the corpus of the PFD so that there are still earnings, and also income taxes, which would capture income from people who come and work in the state and then leave at some point in the year, and we lose that revenue once they've left Alaska. So those are two conversations that you will hear more about in the future. I think I'll leave it at that, because there's a lot of stuff, but one of the conversations that we had with Pat Pitney, she has visited over 25 communities in Alaska with her dog and pony show and the budget calculator to fully inform people about what our future might be like. And she agreed that she would be willing to come to Petersburg to put on a presentation, or would send somebody from her office if we can guarantee her an audience. And I certainly think that we could do that. So I don't know whether we want to do it now or at a later place, but I would ask the Assembly if they would be willing to write a letter and make the invitation that she come and do a presentation in Petersburg.
I think that's something we could put on the next agenda, and it might be something we could, if she or somebody from her office comes, we could have the hospital and the school people here, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of people from the public.
And she herself said it's really important that we have the conversation, that we talk to people we don't agree with, that communities need to be really informed and to think about the various opportunities, what we're willing to give up, what we're not willing to give up, what quality of life are we trying to maintain, and how do we go about doing that.
It's going to be an ongoing discussion.
So, Pat Pitney is the state's budget director, the governor's budget director. And was it from her, or was it the Rasmussen Foundation that talked about, you know, doing the comparisons between what we pay in Alaska for government from a tax perspective as compared to other states?
I think that might have been Rasmussen, but okay. I believe, and I said I was going to give three places where people could find more information other than Liz or myself, because we did bring back some materials. The presentations for everyone who spoke at Southeast Conference will be put up on the Southeast Conference website, so if you go to their website, you can download that information. The budget calculator is on the state's website. I don't know exactly where the location is. Liz May?
It's the governor's website.
Okay. And then the third place to look is raincoastdata.com. And Melana used to work with Southeast Conference. She's the one that now runs Raincoast Data. She generates Southeast by the numbers, and that is on their website. And it's a really interesting slice of where we've been and where we're going, and how the different segments of our economy, how big they are, how they factor into things.
Because that's one of the, I think, what we hear, you know, is that, you know, you need to get rid of all these state jobs, and it's based on her presentation, like you can get rid of every state employee, and we're still nowhere near close to balancing the budget. And I think the one number, and like I said, I think maybe it is Rasmussen that when their study was that we pay $500 a person in taxes to fund our state government. The next closest state to us is paying $1,000
the average is 2,000 to 3,000. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a scary proposition. It's basically saying, you know, back to it, you're not going to solve this by cutting expenses. It's
I think that was the most, you know, most important part of Pat's presentation is it's very clear that cutting anything is not going to be the solution. We have to figure out how to raise revenues.
Yeah.
That was the
Cindy, was there anything, when I was at Southeast or Alaska Municipal League, where the conversation was is that we're not on equal playing field in Alaska. The rail belt, for instance, Anchorage and Fairbanks, has no sales tax, whereas we have a sales tax. And when you're looking at generating revenues, how do you make the playing field equal so that you're beginning from the same point? Was there any discussion at all on those issues?
You know, I think there were more private discussions about that, and I'm on the sustainability committee for Alaska Municipal League, and we put forward some proposals about how to deal with the budget situation. They left sales tax on the table, but the smaller communities were arguing that we don't even want it considered, because small communities in Alaska often have a sales tax. I know Wrangell does, we do. When we get another sales tax statewide laid on top of that, it's an unequal burden to us, say, versus a community like Anchorage, which doesn't have any. And personally, I think some of the revenues from the state should take that into account when they make their allocations, but I don't get to make those decisions.
Unfortunately,
that's not how it works. But to answer your question, it comes up in the conversation, but I don't know if we've figured out quite how to address that. But I know that Pat has heard that.
Okay, any other questions for Cindy? Thanks for the update.
Sure.
That brings us to recognitions. Anybody have any recognitions, staff or assembly members? Yeah. Chief or Donnie, whoever wants to go first.
On Saturday, we will be having a service project that is being spearheaded by a couple of the local churches. Just want to thank them for their efforts to help us with our trails. Also, wanted to thank the Forest Service, who is going to be spending a fair amount of time tomorrow prepping those trails for this service project. It's nice to know that the community continues to support Parks and Recreation and the many, many things that we offer. And so we just want to let them know how much we do truly appreciate that.
All right. Thank you, Don. Chief?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just wanted to publicly thank the Assembly this afternoon for supporting us. This record management system is going to make our life a lot easier, and it's going to help us provide public safety more efficiently and effectively.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cindy?
I have one. I wanted to publicly thank Molly Christensen. When we headed to Southeast Conference, we had a two-hour delay on our flight, flew 14 minutes, and then were canceled in Wrangell and had to spend the night. And Molly was traveling with her two sons to go to a doctor visit down in Seattle, and obviously that didn't happen. She was not being paid. She wasn't working, but the staff at the Wrangell Airport is new and wasn't quite sure how to deal with a plane load of people who were supposed to be making connections in Seattle. She stepped behind the counter and in short order got everybody situated with hotel vouchers and meal vouchers, and did that as unpaid, realized that her help was needed, and just stepped up to the plate. So I wanted to make sure that she got publicly thanked for that. It was really nice.
All right, great. Nice when people step up and help. Any other recognitions? I will entertain a motion to adjourn then.
So moved.
All those in favor? All right. The meeting is over at 1:37.
Petersburg Borough Assembly meetings are brought to you by KFSK and Petersburg Wrangell Insurance, offering asset protection and security through insurance. Home, auto, boat, life. Information from a real live person who's in the same phone book as you. Petersburg Insurance at 772-3858.